Hi, it's Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
And welcome back to Still Watching, the television podcast from Vanity Fair. We cover entire seasons of the hottest shows on television, and right now we are diving deep into the hottest one of them all, House of the Dragon, the Game of Thrones prequel series on HBO. I'm Josh Wigler, and to discuss House of the Dragon episode 6 with me, I am joined once again by Richard Lawson. Richard, hello. It feels like it's been 10 years since last we talked.
I promise the listeners we are the same people who were on this podcast last
week. Just played by different podcasters.
Right. Yeah. It does. Yeah. That we had a big time jump. And some of my predictions about what was going to look like were proved very wrong. But it's an exciting, I feel like we're kind of starting to watch a new show almost.
It does feel a little bit like a second pilot here in House of the Dragon. And I do not think, coincidentally, it is once again directed by Miguel Sapochnik, outgoing co-showrunner here on House of the Dragon and an iconic director in the Game of Thrones franchise, is once again behind the camera on this episode, episode 6, The Princess and the Queen, a very aptly titled episode of House of the Dragon, Richard.
Yes, and had I seen that title before watching the episode, I would have been like, oh, okay, so Rhaenyra is not going to be queen when this episode starts, which is what I assumed was going to happen.
Well, if we had watched the trailer for this episode after episode 5, I think some of our predictions probably would have been very, very different. I don't know if you caught that at all, Richard, but HBO really just decided to let everybody know that Viserys was going to be fine.
I didn't watch that. And the minute he walked out, I was like, oh, okay. I spent maybe 20 minutes talking on this podcast last week about what his death meant. And he's still alive, just minus an arm.
Minus an arm, but still standing as Viserys Targaryen 10 years down the road. At least he is alive. He doesn't look great, but he looks a lot better than I think both of us thought perhaps he would look 10 years down the future.
Yeah, the oozing sores seem to have gone away, so that's good at least.
Gone away or at least covered up.
He found some new makeup from across the narrow sea that really works with his skin tone. And
I have to tell you, I hope we never solve this one. I would like to never know if it's still there or not, but we shall see as we are moving into a decidedly new era for House of the Dragon. Much has been made about the fact that there was going to be a major time jump here in House of the Dragon, that there was going to be a big shuffling of the main cast of House of the Dragon. And indeed, we have arrived at that moment as we have said goodbye to Millie Alcock, who is no longer playing Rhaenyra Targaryen, Emily Carey, no longer playing Queen Alicent. We have Emma Darcy in the role of Rhaenyra and Olivia Cooke leading the way as Alicent moving forward. Before we even break down the episode scene by scene, Richard, which we will definitely do, I wanted to get your top down takes on this, how you're feeling about the new Rhaenyra and Alicent, how this is sitting with you. I think that this has been among my biggest questions about House of the Dragon is how is this recasting going to sit with folks? So the floor is yours, my friend. How are you feeling about this?
I feel pretty good. You know, I had never seen Millie Alcock in anything before. And so I was really pleasantly surprised by what a good actor she is. And I kind of assumed that she was like 17, but she's actually in her 20s. So she could have played slightly older, I suppose. But the minute you see Emma Darcy, you're like, OK, this is an older woman now. Like, you know, this is like a full adult.
Yeah.
So the replacement does make sense. And then Olivia Cooke, it's been one of those kind of, you're happy to see her in a movie or a TV show for years now. So I think they're really good. And that's not a knock on the previous actors who were both great. But I, yeah, the thing I was nervous about, which is what I'd be kind of like watching a whole different character. I think they've done the continuity pretty well.
I think so too. And I'm obviously biased because I know the characters really well from having read Fire and Blood, the book this show is based on. So I have the arcs of these characters fairly clearly in mind for myself. So I can see the trajectory from Millie Alcock to Emma Darcy pretty easily, and from Emily Carey to Olivia Cooke as well. But I think that like a lot of solid bedrock, right, exists in those earlier performances that allows for these new versions of these characters to thrive in this episode. But I also think just the performances themselves of what Emma Darcy and Olivia Cooke are bringing to the table as Rhaenyra and Alicent, so strong in their own right. I'm to understand that there were really no meetings, no conversations between the two generations of these characters. So that's fairly impressive to me. Yeah. I think it speaks a lot to the clarity of the writing of the characters as well. I feel like in that regard, Richard, it doesn't feel like it really missed a beat. And once again, we've talked about this a little bit on the podcasts as well. There is sort of this frozen in amber quality about some of the enmity that exists between these characters from when we last saw them to where we pick up a decade down the line.
Yeah, it's just kind of compounded and festered. Yes. But it's interesting to find, you know, throughout this episode, an Alicent who has hardened from the sort of more innocent person she was before the time jump. Whereas I kind of feel like Rhaenyra in some ways has kind of softened a little bit. She's not quite as impetuous or whatever because she's grown up and matured a bit and also had a decade or however long of that in that kind of waiting room, wondering like when am I actually going to take the throne if I do at all.
Right.
So it's interesting to see them almost flipped a little bit, but still feeling like the people that we just spent five episodes with.
Yeah, another question that I have, and I don't have the answer to this one, so I'm curious to get your take and to talk it through. Do you get the sense that Rhaenyra and Alicent have had a major conversation about, hey, I thought we were doing all right. What happened? You know, when we're kind of seeing them in this episode, I don't get the sense that Rhaenyra has a ton of information as to why Alicent really so strictly turned against her.
Yeah, that's a good point. Because obviously we know what Alicent's, you know, her grudge is, but yeah, I'm not sure. It doesn't seem from the context clues we have in this episode, it seems like basically most of their interactions are sort of forced by Queen Alicent, or during, you know, the King's Council meetings, which they both seem to be on. But that's in front of other people. So they have to at least abide by some stiff formality. Pleasantry. But yeah, I kind of feel like when they don't have to be together, like if they haven't been, one of them hasn't been summoned or whatever, they just don't speak.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to be really curious to know what everyone else out there thinks about the recasting. If you are immediately gripped by these new versions of Rhaenyra and Alicent, or if it was a little whiplashy for you, write in. We would love to hear that feedback. stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. That's the way to get a hold of us. stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. Let us know what you think of the new Rhaenyra, the new Alicent. We would love to get those takes from you for the podcast next week. Richard, I think it's time to dig into The Princess and the Queen, episode 6. Let's take a very quick break, and then we will hop all the way in back to Westeros 10 years down the line. Stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
I'm Claire Fallon. And I'm Emma Gray. We're culture writers, podcasters, and hosts of the show Love to See It.
Every week, we give an unapologetically feminist dissection of reality dating shows, rom-coms, and other romance narratives. We unpack all the weird messages they send us about love, sex, and dating.
And we dive into all the details with special guests like actors, authors, and cultural critics.
You can find Love to See It wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes drop every Tuesday.
All right, Richard. 10 years, 10 long years have passed since that horrible wedding, the wedding that that shall be, is it the green wedding? Is that what we're calling it, you think, moving forward?
Yeah, that works.
The green wedding works for us. 10 years down the line, and we are brought back into House of the Dragon with yet another laborious labor scene here on House of the Dragon. You're home.
Yeah, what a brutal parallel to the first half of this season, but a really effective way to just throw us in medias res into the new time. You know, there's struggle, but there's also change and growth and development in the form of, you know, all of these children that now exist and are old enough to, well, do things on windowsills, but we can talk about that later.
Yeah. The longer we can go without having to talk about that one, I would love to make it a good chunk of time before we have to get there. But we do have to get there. But we begin with Rhaenyra is in the middle of giving birth to her new baby son, who is going to be named Joffrey after her husband Laenor's late lover, who we lost at the end of episode 5. But before he even gets a name, before we even have Laenor meet the child, Richard, we have the baby in the world for all of what? 10 seconds before the command of the queen to present the child to her immediately comes down the pipeline.
Yeah, partly, I think, just to fuck with her, but also, obviously, Alicent has to keep an eye on every one of these kids, you know, because as she says later, this is now in play. Like, we are in this now. And, you know, was she inspecting the baby to see, oh, maybe it's frail, maybe it's this, maybe it's that. I don't know. But like, it's also just, an exertion of control. And clearly Rhaenyra doesn't want to be the weaker party. So she drags herself out. And it's a really brutal, long, extended kind of walk up to the king's chambers. And you know, I felt it. It's almost like a version of the shame walk.
Yeah, I think that's a really good pull. You know, it sort of has that that West Wing vibe, the Westeros wing of the walk and talk through the hallway, but with such a Game of Thrones spin on it. You know, she has just finished giving birth to this child and she is immediately on her feet. A line that I really appreciated in this moment is one of the people who was there helping her deliver the child says, "You should remain in bed." She says, "Yeah, I should." But she can't, you know, because the stakes are too high. And you have to imagine at this point, Rhaenyra knows that Alicent's eyes are on these children. As we're going to get deeper into this episode very soon here, in fact, Alicent is looking to see who do these children look like? Do they look like your husband, Rhaenyra, or do they look like somebody else who might have a role to play here in King's Landing? She is very invested in that, and I think Rhaenyra's protectiveness of the secret is rightfully placed and needs to be around for this introduction of her child to someone who used to be her best friend and has quickly become her worst enemy.
Yeah, and Alicent isn't really subtle about that. I mean, she literally says to Laenor, like, "Well, keep trying. Maybe one of them will look like you someday."
Yeah,
you
know, straight out of the book, that one.
Yeah. Oh, is it really? Yeah, it's a good line and well delivered. And yeah, I mean, I think the interesting thing about Alicent, you know, her knowledge of this, I mean, it's pretty much an open secret, it seems like, among the, you know, these very elite few about the parentage of Rhaenyra's kids. But that is a really dangerous cudgel to be even, you know, even gesturing toward. Alicent isn't wielding it yet, but like, you know, it's interesting to see her kind of committed to the stakes of this, you know, so-called game, which are pretty deadly. And the Alicent we saw before the time jump wasn't quite there. And she seems to have gotten there now. And I think it complicates an already interesting character.
She had just shown up to that place, right? You know, she just got there. She put the green dress on. She signaled for war. She maybe recruits Sir Criston. It certainly seems by this episode and the relationship they have that Criston is very much team Alicent 10 years down the line. But yeah, this is what 10 years of that mood looks like. You said festering, and I think that that's absolutely right. The seething resentments that have built to this place. Allison is a lot more comfortable in the viewpoint. I don't know if comfortable is the right word, but is a lot more fixed in the viewpoint of, frankly, her father. That conversation that her father had with her at the start of episode 5 is going to be very much reflected in the conversation that Allison has with her son, Aegon, on the other side of that scene that I don't want to talk about until we absolutely have to talk about it. But it is really interesting the way that she's kind of becoming her dad in certain regards.
Yeah, which was probably inevitable. I mean, I guess one strategy for her would just be kind of like shrink into the background. You know, right. I've been watching a lot of Survivor lately.
Ooh, look at you.
Yeah. And there are the people who get to the end because they just kind of coasted or they hid behind someone. And they're the people who make strategic moves. And it seems like Allison has definitely chosen the latter.
Yeah.
And the thing with Kristen is interesting because I don't even feel like he's pro Allison. He's just really anti Rhaenyra. And but that works, you know, it does the trick, but he does have to catch himself sometimes with his aggression, because I think there is still in Allison some old sort of primal affection for her old friend. And I'm just really curious to see how that develops, if they'll ever be aligned at any point by the end of this season or next season or whatever, because I think there's still something, a connection there.
Doesn't feel like a final two deal showing up between Allison and Rhaenyra anytime right. soon, yeah. I have to say.
Yeah.
There's a Joffrey Probst joke in here somewhere. I can't quite get it. So Laenor is going to join Rhaenyra on this long walk to Queen Alicent. Some dialogue that I thought was pretty biting. Sarah Hess is the credited writer of this episode of House of the Dragon, where he asks Sir Richard, "Was it terribly painful?" Is his first question.
Yeah.
And he tries to relate by saying, "I took a lance through the shoulder once."
And she's like, "My condolences."
Yeah, my deepest sympathies.
I like the way that their relationship has developed too.
Yes.
You know, there's obviously some resentment. It's not jealousy on Rhaenyra's part. It's more of an out roll of the eyes at all of Laenor's, you know, kind of antics. But they are definitely, back to the Survivor, they are in an alliance.
Yes.
And they know that. And I think that has over the years bred some affection.
Yeah, for sure. So they make it to Allison's chambers. They get past a very curt nod from Kristen Cole, the most together he seems in this episode. And Allison, she is really playing the part. Rhaenyra, you should be resting. She gets her a cushion. She allows her to sit down. And here comes old King Viserys, the new old king on the block, down one arm. What do you think he's going to be missing next week, Richard? It feels like we're just shrinking away, this guy.
Maybe his hair. I mean, that looks like it's almost gone anyway.
It's on its way.
But yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I really did think we were done with him. But that he's still around is, I kind of like, because, you know, he hasn't really learned from his past. Like, he's kind of a sentimental guy. He's kind of a softy in his way. And like, clearly that's still a big part of him, but that functions more interestingly now because his daughter and his wife, are now old enough that they can be sort of the aggressive ones, and he can really just, you know, be in that sort of grandpa role. But he's not, you know, toothless. So I'll be curious to see how he factors into things.
He isn't, but he is, as he's going to be, I believe the phrase willfully blind gets bandied about twice in this episode. And at least once that is applied to Viserys himself, seemingly the only person in Westeros who does not know that Breakbones is the true father of these children. And as you mentioned earlier, Allison is going to look at the child after Viserys has said, "Oh, he has your nose," to Sir Laenor. Allison is going to look at the child and tell Laenor, "Sooner or later, you will make one that looks like you." Very, very loaded line.
Yes, yes. Especially, you know, with the casting, you know, we have black actors on here. And one of them is Rhaenyra's husband. And obviously that would be an indicator of something, I would think. But I don't know that the show is ever going to address that kind of matter. But it adds an interesting texture to everything.
When Rhaenyra and Laenor get back to their chambers, we get to meet her two oldest children, her two oldest sons, Jacerys, a.k.a. Jace, and Lucerys, a.k.a. Luke. just easy enough to go with Jace and Luke. And certainly that's how they're going to be mostly referred to on the show. And now they have a younger brother of their own. And we're really meeting the full family because we are getting reintroduced to Sir Harwin Strong, a.k.a. Breakbones. Were you surprised at his role in this? And I guess my question also, to put more of a point on it, is did the show up to this point, through five episodes, do enough to establish Breakbones for you that his role in this episode, forget his introduction here as the father of these children, but the emotional beat at the end of the episode of losing this man, was enough of that work done for you to really get invested here?
I don't think so, honestly.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
If I hadn't talked to you for this podcast and you kind of were like, yeah, that's an interesting family to pay attention to, I think he wouldn't have registered at all. It also doesn't help that he looks a lot like Kristen.
Yeah.
And is often in similar costuming. And and maybe there's a sort of deliberate point there where, like, I guess Rhaenyra has a type, you know, that isn't, you know, her uncle. I wish they had put that foundation down a little bit better. There's nothing from the past five episodes that I would have excised in favor of that, but maybe to find a way to just integrate him a bit more. So when we really realize what's going on, where he has these, it's a tragedy. He has these children who he can't call his children, who, you know, he can be close to in some ways, but always whispered about. And I think that there would have been more depth to that if we knew him a bit better.
I'm of a couple of minds about this, because this is something that we've talked about a bit. Of one of the things that the Game of Thrones universe does so well is they throw a character out at you that feels very realized, that feels like you could follow their exploits into a different adventure, your Rhea Royces of the world, as a most recent example. And I think Breakbones fulfills that. I think that there's so much to this character, especially with his role with Rhaenyra and his role as his relation to these three children, especially, that there's more to explore here. There's more to unearth. And yet, this is how you get to care about these characters being removed from the board and what that means for the people that they leave behind. That being said, I absolutely agree that more work could have been done. I love Breakbones in the book as he is written. You know, roughly around this same period of time is when he is written out of the book. But I think the book just makes him so much more of a clear character. And part of me wonders, to your point of not excising anything from the previous five episodes, maybe can we push the Breakbones death a little further down the road? Like, can that be in episode seven kind of deal?
Yeah, I mean, I think that when I reviewed the show and I had seen the first five episodes, one of the bigger criticisms I had for it was that, unlike the original series, which really took its time laying track, you know, things happened suddenly on occasion, but like there was a lot more build. And I think this show is moving at a swifter clip, and you know, something happens, two scenes later, we see its consequence, you know, and someone says something, two scenes later, that thing is addressed, you know, and right. I think that with this, it's like, we could have sat with Breakbones and his relationship with Rhaenyra and those children a bit longer, just let it steep a bit more. So we really feel, I mean, the episode is playing up this horrible death, this, you know, fiery death, as like a big moment, but I didn't feel it, I guess, and I kind of wish I did.
I don't think you're going to be alone in that. I really liked what Ryan Corr, the actor, was doing with Breakbones, the goofy grin, him meeting Rhaenyra in the alleyway of King's Landing, his father, who also we are losing in this episode, giving him that curt nod of instruction of, yeah, go break up the fight at the end of the wedding. These were all really fun details for me as somebody who knew that our time with Breakbones would be short. I just didn't think it would be quite this short.
Yeah.
And considering how important he is to this family specifically, I do feel like we could have spent more time with him. And I also think that there's going to be a decent degree of the people who aren't listening to this podcast or other podcasts, or, you know, doing their extracurriculars on House of the Dragon. Those people on Sunday nights are like, wait, who is this guy? I don't fully understand who this guy is. That's a shame.
I guess they kind of just wanted to get us to the point where we realize what Larys is doing and how powerful he is and sinister he is. And also, we want to have this sort of avenging warrior Rhaenyra activated, you know.
Also with Larys, like what he's willing to shave off, you know, like how far he's willing to go. That's his brother. That's his dad. If he's willing to do that as sort of his first major move, this might be a scary guy to look out for. So,
yes. Yeah.
Okay, let's go to the Dragon Pit. Always a good idea, as we are going to have four of the children here that are going to be newly important to the show. Certainly in this era of House of the Dragon, we have two of Viserys and Alicent's children. We have two of Rhaenyra and Laenor's children, aka Breakbone's children. We've got Jace, who is trying to bond with the dragon Vermax to sort of solidify the deal of his bond with this specific dragon. Again, the riders really get the one dragon. One dragon will have many riders, but this is a very big deal for Jace. And it seems like everybody in the room has a dragon here. We have Prince Aegon here, who is played, I believe that that's Ty Tennant, who is David Tennant's son. So another interesting Doctor Who connection here on House of the Dragon, who is playing Prince Aegon.
And you're telling me that wasn't Finn Wolfhard?
I thought Finn Wolfhard, I could see. I was thinking some Timothy Chalamet into there as well. There's Aemon is his younger brother, who is currently without a dragon and is going to be pretty annoyed when his brother and his two cousins present him with the pink dread, just a flying pig. This kid Aemon really is not no sense of humor on this kid.
Yeah, I think that this scene is so well done because it's in quick, you know, fashion. It really sets the scene of this kind of this very weird social dynamic that these four boys have and the other kids too, presumably, of like, this is my uncle, but I technically have more power than him because I'm going to in the line of succession way before he is. And, you know, and that kind of like moment that Aegon has later where it's like, you guys aren't just like friends playing around anymore. Like this is, we have to think about this seriously. And I think that the scene in the Dragon Pit does a really good job of showing that they are still young. They're still pulling stupid pranks, but there's a new tension to that, that they really need to be more cognizant of.
Yeah, I think also it's a really great job on the show's part of setting this here for, you know, the courtyard battle that we're going to get into a few scenes from now, of just the generational trauma that's trickling downhill, right? You know, Rhaenyra and Alicent were in many ways not responsible for the positions that they were in and the increasing tensions based on the positions that they are put in, whether that's by birth in the case of Rhaenyra or appointment and, you know, manipulation by the part of Alicent's father. And now here they are with their own kin, with their own children. And this you know, this tension that Alicent especially is going to be instilling in Aegon a few scenes from now is happening again, as they say, on a totally different show.
Yeah. 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 And you feel for them. I mean, that's, you know, even though we see two of the kids being, you know, jerks in this scene, like, I was thinking about this recently because of the death of Queen Elizabeth and now we have King Charles and like that, those kids and Harry leaving. It's just like, what a shitty thing to be born into in a way, you know, you can have, yes, you're rich and you have privileges and all that stuff that helps, probably better that than being in Flea Bottom or whatever. But like, it's weird to think about in real life and also in the world of this show of like that moment where you're like, all right, now I have to actually think about what I was born into and what my role is. And I have to kind of forsake basically the rest of my life to just like devote myself to this kind of dynasty, I guess.
Yeah. Aemon is not going to be content with the arrival of the pink dread. Aemon wants to go deeper into the Dragon Pit. I think Ron Burgundy would tell him this was a bad idea. But he is going to descend deeper and deeper towards this groaning, glowing, lure down in the bowels of the Dragon Pit. And he will see this one dragon that nearly roasts him alive. And Aemon is lucky to escape with his life intact. And he, when he is getting chastised by his mother, one scene later, he does not seem to have really regretted his actions. I don't know how much he learned from trying to woo this dragon, Richard.
Yeah, and it seems this is not the first time this has happened. You know, this is a pattern for him. And I'm curious. Like, you know, I remember watching the original Game of Thrones and being like, is Tommen ever going to be like in this? Or I forget the daughter's name.
Marcella,
who, you know, and they have their moments, both and tragically. But like, I think that these scenes with these kids, my hope is that they're telling us that like, these are going to be major characters going forward. This dynamic is really important. Maybe not necessarily this season, but like, we need to get to know these people to better understand where the story's going.
Yeah, I think that you can count on some of these characters being fleshed out a good deal more, especially with the way that time has been moving. And what I'll say is, while the big, big recastings of Rhaenyra and Alicent are underway, we do not have other actors that are going to be stepping into those roles. Some of these children, at the very least, you will see other actors at a certain point in time. So you can look forward to that for sure. I thought it was very interesting, the scene with Alicent and her daughter, Helaena, who is, what is she doing? Just studying bugs? She's learning the way of the leeches, Richard, so that she can...
She wants to be one of those creepy maesters who like skulk around the castle or something.
Yeah, runs in the family.
Maybe it is for dad. Yeah, that could be it.
She has an interesting line when Alicent is talking to Aemon that I clocked, that I just want to put a pin in, where she tells her son, Alicent says to Aemon, "You'll have a dragon someday." And Helaena sort of just offhandedly is minding the worm she's looking at. She says, "He'll have to close an eye." We'll revisit that. We'll see what that looks like at another point in time. Alicent is going to confront Viserys about the idea that these children, that Rhaenyra's kids, do not belong to Laenor. Viserys just wants to talk about horses. He'll do anything to talk about how, don't even think about that. That's not a thing. They're Laenor's kids. Let's not look at this. These are wild accusations. Just put them away. Don't even think about that. I think of Viserys 10 years down the line, who is still really set, Richard, on Rhaenyra sitting on the Iron Throne. He does not want to engage any of this. He wants nothing to do with this discourse.
I mean, I think that is born of a genuine love for his daughter, but also he doesn't want to admit that he kind of screwed a lot up when he made that decision. And it was probably the right decision, you know, on principle, but like, it's already created problems. It's about to create a lot more, you get the feeling. And I think he's just like, la 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 la, no, it's fine, everything's fine, we're all one big happy family, don't worry about it. Sometimes a black horse can give birth to a brown horse or whatever, you know. He's just kind of saying like, I don't know what you're talking about, I don't see any problem.
Yeah,
but he does. I mean, I think he does deeper down know that like, this is a really messy situation that he is at the center of.
I think we've talked about this a good amount of Viserys knows the landscape. You know, these things aren't necessarily getting by him. I think he is just somebody who has been so overwhelmed and ill-suited for this job to do anything about some of this stuff. So I think that read resonates within me in terms of how I'm reading Viserys. I think if he really was alone and he was allowed to really confront it, I think that he would see that Rhaenyra and Harwin are a thing, and that these children are the product of that relationship as opposed to Rhaenyra and Laenor. But to admit that, it's just too much. It's too much. The way that all falls apart, all of the untethering, all of the knots to untie from something like that, makes the Meereenese knot that has prevented George R. R. Martin from finishing his book series look pretty easy to untangle in comparison.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. So Alicent is going to vent with Criston Cole, that of course the king knows. He's just making excuses. He's really on her side, and he has some horrific things to say about Rhaenyra. He calls her brazen and relentless, a spider who stings and sucks her prey dry, and then says something that crosses such a line that even Alicent can't weather hearing that about Rhaenyra. And Criston has to say, "That's beneath me, Your Grace. I apologize for that."
Yeah. And in the UK, that word carries a little less weight than it does in the US and presumably in Westeros, but we're not going to say it.
We're not going to say it. It shan't be me who is. I'm grateful that you have accepted me into your home here at Vanity Fair. I'm not going to be the one who does that on a Vanity Fair podcast or any podcast.
So my question about this scene and about Criston in this episode, and maybe going forward, is this all pettiness about Rhaenyra breaking his heart, turning down his proposal, or does he now care about like propriety of the kingdom or of, you know, or is he like sworn in sort of not just in word, but also in like feeling to Allison? I don't know yet, but like right now it's funny to watch this sexy, noble character from earlier episodes become this petty, like kind of angry kind of incel adjacent kind
of guy. I mean, take adjacent out, I think. It's really fascinating to me, and it's something that has not worked absolutely for everybody, but one of the things that I actually am quite enjoying about the time skips that we've experienced on the show is how much you can, like, certain injuries just live with you for a long time. And certain experiences just stay with you. It doesn't matter days, months, years, a decade. You can still be living in that moment. A part of you just was left there, and you're left to carry that with you. I think Kristen Cole still nursing the wounds that we saw him, sustain at the end of episode 5, throughout episode 5, that carrying with him into the very next episode would emotionally track for me, for sure. How he would present that, though, Richard, to the degree that you're talking about, I think that's interesting. I think that's an interesting observation. Like, oh, it's for the realm. It's for the realm.
Right, right. Yeah. I think these scenes also do a really good job of, like, you know, conjuring up, imagining what it would be like to just kind of age into adolescence and adulthood, where basically you hang out with the same six people all the time in one, and you all live in the same building. Like, you know, it's just like there obviously we have really dire matters of state and like deadly things swirling around all this, but some of the energy that we're seeing in kind of a clever way is just like just bored, pampered people who are like sick of each other, you know, and I think that that's credible to me, like that these people are not, you know, impetuous teenagers anymore, but like they haven't really actually had a chance to like mature separate of one another. And so, of course, these old wounds don't heal very well because there's no air to help them heal.
Yeah. And no leeches either. They're all being devoted to the one guy. All right, we've reached the scene. We have no choice but to discuss it. Richard, I'm old enough to remember when Prince Aegon was playing with his porridge, and that was a big deal. Here we have him standing in the window, doing his business, as Allison walks in, and I don't know. It's just a lot. This is a lot.
She doesn't seem fazed by it, which is kind of funny.
Completely unfazed. He kind of almost seems a little unfazed as well.
Yeah. I mean, he's like a little embarrassed, but he's just like, eh, whatever. I would have jumped out the window, you know, like if that was me.
Right.
But, you know, that window thing, again, we have like this show is doing a nice little job of subtle echoes. Like we have Tommen's End, you know, in a very similar window. In this case, it's, I think, showing how that Aegon is a bit high on his own supply. Like he's gazing down at his, I mean, imagined subjects or whatever, like, and doing that. And I think, again, that's it's a bold way to sort of tell us more about the character, but it does, it's effective.
I think it tells you a lot. Yeah, I think it tells you how, I think it certainly should angle your thinking a little bit, and like, either it's the readiness of this guy should the day come that, you know, he is in this position where what happens when his father dies, and if the worst comes to worst, as Otto Hightower has predicted, and now as Allison is going to instill in him, that you are the challenge to Rhaenyra, Aegon. It's you just by living and breathing. Should that day come where Aegon needs to step into some position of leadership, either this kid is not ready for it now, or it's a little bit of a window into the future of what he might be like in that position anyway, which is to say, I think, I think the metaphor is very apparent of someone who could not care less about the people beneath him.
Yeah, exactly.
So Allison is going to really try and instill this in him. You know, stop playing around with your cousins. Stop making nice
and
with
yourself.
Rhaenyra's kids and yourself. Please cover up. You know, focus up because this is very serious. I think is what she's trying to say.
She says, you know, her sons are not going to be your playthings for much longer, you know, like, or if they, you know, they aren't already, you know, and that I, from her perspective, this is a mortal issue. Like, this is a really, really, really serious issue. And to see that I mean, there's kind of a heartbreak in there because like she just wants these kids probably to be, you know, just have fun with their cousins and be normal. But like they are, I guess, nephew.
Right.
But they can't, you know, and, you know, she had to learn that lesson at a young age. And, she, her son is now about that age, too. And she's like, we have to get serious here. And I think it's going to be a hard road for that kid. I'm guessing.
So we go across the narrow sea at this point. We're going to spend a little bit of time in Pentos and we're going to catch up with what has life been like these past 10 years for Prince Daemon. And it turns out that flirtation at the end of the wedding between Daemon and Elena Valerion has manifested in the form of a full-on marriage. They've got a family. They have two twin daughters, Bela and Reyna. And on top of that, Lena Valerion has a dragon, and it's not just any dragon. I don't know. Did you clock the significance of her dragon, Richard?
She said it was the biggest, right?
Yes.
But is there, what else am I missing?
So this is another one where I do think, I don't know what the solution is. Do we need like the glowing title card on this one? But I think it's worth really underscoring. This is Vhagar, the dragon. This is the oldest living dragon in Westeros. This is one of the three and the only surviving currently dragons that were part of Aegon's conquest all the way back when the Seven Kingdoms were united as one. And throughout her appearances on the show, a couple of times Vhagar has been name-checked. But that scene when Lena was 12 years old and going on that walk alongside, I guess, her future brother-in-law in Viserys, she was asking about Vhagar. Has anyone seen Vhagar? Where is Vhagar? I hear he's nesting somewhere off the coast of the Narrow Sea. Somewhere between that scene and whether it had happened, by the time we were at the wedding, I'm not sure. I don't think so as per the show, but maybe. But somewhere between that scene when she was 12 and where she is now as Daemon's wife, she has claimed Vhagar, the largest dragon in all of Westeros, as her own. Feels like something that would have been nice to see on screen.
Yeah, because I still don't think I fully understand where her family, because I from the original Game of Thrones, in my mind, the Targaryens were the only people who rode dragons. But like clearly there's another family that it does, at least. And I don't quite get how Lena and her family, like where they exactly fit into that sort of lore and structure.
Yeah. So it's the Valyrian descent. It's that the Sea Snake and his family, House Valyrian, they descend from old Valyria as well. So the blood of the dragon runs in their veins too.
So the dragon is a Valyrian thing, not specifically a Targaryen thing.
Right. So they do have that connection, and they have a whole mess of dragons at their disposal as well. So that, I think, is something that could be clearer, too, mm-hmm. I think is totally fair to level at the show. And I really, especially seeing as we have Lena in this episode and then we do not, would have been a nice thing, I think, to have on the show to see how did that come together. Feels like a pretty important piece of the puzzle that's not all together here. Maybe some exposition further on down the line will help this out. But something that I felt was missing.
I agree. And I think in general, obviously Daemon was a huge, important character in the first five episodes, and I don't think they're done with him by any means. But like this segment of this episode, all of his scenes, I'm having a hard time imagining where he's going to fit back in, like what his goal is going to be. Like, obviously, right. I would assume he and Rhaenyra still have something of a bond or something, that with each other, even though there is obviously a lot of resentment and tension between them. But like, I don't know, I'm just curious, like, so maybe this episode, it was introducing us to Daemon's life and further expounding on an interesting character in Lena. And then by the end of the episode, they're like, oh no, just kidding. That's all kind of done. And now Daemon has to kind of re-enter the regular fold of the show.
Right. I mean, it's the John Wick thing, maybe. Right.
Yeah,
People keep asking me if I'm back. He's saying that he's retired from the game. Right. And Lena's kind of accusing him of that as well, the further that they're going to get into conversation. So right now they're in Pentos across the Narrow Sea in Essos. They are being pitched on sticking around and taking up residence here effectively. We're also hearing that the Triarchy, the same organization that backed the Crab Feeder once upon a while, that they have aligned now with Prince of Dorne, and they are retaking the Stepstones. And so past is prologue, right? History is repeating in so many different ways here on the show. And Daemon is sort of being approached to be an ally in this situation and maybe help us out the way that the Targaryens once did. But when Laena is going to speak with Daemon, she's going to express that, I just want to go home. I don't want to be here. I want to go back to Driftmark. I want my children to be raised like the badass dragon riders that they ought to be. And for whatever reason, Daemon just wants to read books. It seems to be where he's at right now. So any kind of through line on that, you're not seeing terribly clearly right now.
Yeah, no. I mean, it is interesting that in some way, Daemon is kind of living the life that Kristen proposed to Rhaenyra.
Right.
Like, let's just leave. Like, let's live well elsewhere, you know, and kind of be our own people. And even though Daemon 10 years ago was so power hungry, now he's had some time away and he's like, what was that really all about? And so I'm just curious what the death of Laena will kind of reinstill in him. Like, will he just kind of take her longing to be home and make it his own?
Right, right. So we get to this courtyard scene back in King's Landing. And everybody is training under the tutelage of Criston Cole. We have him fighting off Aegon and Aemond at one point. And Sir Harwin Strong, who is the new commander of the City Watch, not for long, for two reasons, is going to be walking by and basically saying, you're showing so much favoritism to these two. You should be applying all of your methods to all your pupils. And yada, yada, yada. Aegon, at Kristen's urging, is going to really knock the living daylights out of Jace. Harwin does not like that. Kristen calls Harwin out as the real father of these kids. And it's a whole big mess. It's Kristen who's now on the ground getting his head punched in. That at least was satisfying.
Yeah. And this is not some simple fight that everyone's like, all right, break it up, break it up. You know, this is serious. This has like really, really big consequences, you know. And I think that the show, it does that in an interesting way where at first I was like, oh, okay, they're having a scuffle, whatever. And then only a few scenes later do you realize, no, that was a really big deal that that happened.
Yeah, it was confirmation in the eyes of a lot of people that even the willfully blind Viserys has to kind of take pause. Not enough that he is going to, go the extreme route of executing Harwin Strong as his father, as Lionel certainly fears. He's going to tell Harwin when they're going to speak later and Rhaenyra is overhearing it, that the only thing that's standing between you and the headsman is Viserys's willful blindness. Right. towards Rhaenyra and refusing to believe that this could possibly be true. But short of that, it's just so public. It is the rumors made manifest.
Yeah. Yeah. And, it makes me kind of think just a little theory I'm developing that like, when it comes to it, I feel like Kristen will be dead at Rhaenyra's hands, because my guess is that she will be vengeful about what happens to Harwin. Maybe not right away, but like this is now like now Kristen has provoked something really bad and kind of a bell that you can't unring, you know. And so I think that schism between them is only going to deepen and can probably in classic Game of Thrones style only be, resolved in one way.
I feel like this is a good moment to just address Lionel Strong, who is going to try and resign as a result of this scene. Him yelling at Harwin, him taking his son aside and trying to instill in him the consequences of what he's done, the stakes that are at play. This is going to be a final episode for Gavin Spokes as Lionel Strong as well, who I think is a character that was really richly realized on this show. One of the few people, even in his resignation, Richard, who has like the kingdom first, like the good of the realm and the nobility of the realm. One of those really rare examples of people on a Game of Thrones show that actually has something other than himself and other than his pride in mind as a priority. I hate to lose that guy. He specifically, Gavin Spokes, the actor, really made me feel for Lionel Strong. Yeah. This is one character that I hope that other people are sad to lose him as well, because it's a real loss. I do think it's a big loss for the show.
Yeah, yeah. And a tricky character in that you're like, well, okay, when did he know that this was going on with his son and the, heir to be? like you would think strategically, he'd be like, I'm going to cut it off or you have to go home. this cannot happen. You know, this is disastrous for all of us. Or if kind of like Viserys, he was sort of looking the other way. You know, I don't know. And we won't know now, unfortunately. But like, yeah, I mean, it's just like these people keep Rhaenyra keeps drawing people closer to her. And then not even in her adulthood now, not really thinking through what that could mean for them. I mean, it's usually something bad.
Which is funny to you know, start getting into that conversation, considering this next scene where her husband comes back he is not aware that this has all just happened, that there was this huge public fight and that Harwin has basically been outed as the true father of these kids. And Laenor is here with his new partner, Sir Carl, who is talking to him about the war in the Stepstones and all of this is happening again. There's a Tyroshi general with a purple beard who has a name that I am going to botch. Rakalio Rindoon, I think, is the name of that character that's being referenced here. I'm going to have to hear someone sound that out. Maybe got to go back to the audiobook. But he's pining for the old days of war. He's, you know, he's bored as well. And he just wants to go back to that. He's done his duty, he's going to tell Rhaenyra. And Rhaenyra's like, you haven't really done it enough. You have to keep doing it. In fact, this is not something that you just do once and then it is over. You have to stay here. And if you're not going to listen to reason, then you'll have to listen to my command.
Yeah. She's like, you've been on enough gay cruises that ended war. We're not doing that anymore.
Not again.
Yeah. But you see, like, you know, in this scene and in a later one, like that she's not like nothing about Laenor's like private life bothers her at all. You know, right. She's like, it's fine. This is what we agreed upon, you know, so long ago. It's just that like the state, the circumstances have changed, like wake up, you know, and you know, he seems kind of almost like Aegon. Laenor seems someone who just refuses to acknowledge that he is, you know, much closer to the center of all of this than he wants to be. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, maybe it's just past history with gay characters on this show, but like, I don't feel like he's long for this world in some fashion. You know, I think he's on very thin ice. It feels like
he at the very least is not thrilled with this current life. And there is something that he is longing for that he's not getting in this situation. And whether or not he's going to be able to get that, he is going to accompany Rhaenyra to Dragonstone by the end of this. And Sir Carl is invited too. So
it's funny. It, speaking of Matt Smith, like it's this arc is sort of similar to the one we saw Prince Philip, played by Matt Smith, have on The Crown.
Yeah.
Where it's like, my wife is the important one. I'm kind of frustrated. Like, I'm bored. I want to go gallivant around adventuring. You know, I don't want to quit the Navy, which Prince Philip had to do, you know. There. I wonder if there was some parallel thinking there when this whole story was being written.
First gentleman, tough gig.
Yeah.
Tough gig, it seems like. Well, speaking of Matt Smith, we are going to focus on him again in Pentos. Really, the point of this is a lot of what we've been talking about already, is that he's just saying, I don't really miss Westeros at all. I've got really nothing there. I want to be out of the Game of Thrones. I would like to have my own spinoff, please. And I would like for it to just be me reading books. And Laena is not buying it. And I don't think that the audience is particularly buying it as well. And so I don't think the audience is particularly believing it either. But I think we've talked it through. I don't think that there's too much more to get into there right now. The small council scene, I think, is really great. And I think a really important scene, too. Can I start with the unimportant piece that is... I don't know if they'll do this on the show. They mention, they're talking about River Run. They're talking about the Tullys, Lady Catelyn's family from Game of Thrones. And they mention a Lord Grover. And they mention Lord Grover's son, but they do not name his son. And I believe Lord Grover's son in the book is also unnamed. But Lord Grover's grandson and Lord Grover's great-grandchildren do have names. And I swear to you, Richard, on all the things that I swear upon, their names are Elmo, Kermit, and Oscar.
No.
And it's not... It's not impossible that they will show up on this show at some point in time.
Oh my gosh.
Because at least one or two of them definitely have fairly important roles to play in some of this stuff. And I really want to know, does House of the Dragon have it in it to have Sesame Street named characters on its show in important roles.
Well, Warner Brothers owns Sesame Street now, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like it's on HBO Max, so they
for
could
now, yeah.
They could borrow the names. That's so funny. What a little, like, clearly, you know, it planted in there as a kind of a joke, but now they actually might have to do it.
They might have to do it.
Yeah,
to funny. Go there. Yeah. I think George was tired. George was tired. You know, he's trying to get books out. So everybody at the small council, no one's looking particularly great, which I thought was worth noting. Viserys is in pain. There is this man, Lord Beesbury, who we haven't seen a ton of, but is a character that I really liked in the book, who is thinking that they're briefly talking about the Brackens and the Blackwoods, and that's the feud that we saw at the start of episode 4 with the young boy who killed the other kid, or stabbed the other kid at the very least. He thinks they're still talking about that. They've moved on to another subject. I think the point being, between that and the very open enmity between Rhaenyra and Allison, this is just not a table that's all together.
No, it's not. And it's a really great scene for a number of reasons, but my favorite is just seeing Allison and Rhaenyra, like, they are powerful voices there, you know, not just because of their stations, but because they're smart and they're strategic and they're, you know, they think ahead. And, you know, it's interesting that we spent, you know, so much time in the first, well, let's say maybe two episodes of this show with everyone being like, a woman ruler, we can never do it. And now all of a sudden there are two women on the King's Council, you know,
right.
Granted, it's his wife and his daughter, but like still like that feels significant. And they are not just sort of passive members of this committee. They are very much involved. And again, I think it shows more of the sort of interesting character development specifically for Allison.
Yeah, they're the only two characters that are really talking sense in this scene. You know, they're speaking with, like, you know, full volume, you know, fully broadcasting their beliefs on what is right for the realm, the situation in the Stepstones, the fact that this is rearing its head once again. It's just emblematic of no one knows how to fix the sink. You know, they have different opinions on it, that Allison says that the cost of fortifying the Stepstones, it just wasn't worth it considering the funds that we do have. And Rhaenyra is the one saying fortifying it would be less expensive than if we have to go to war in the Stepstones again. So it's this very cross conversation between the two of them who feel that they're both really, really right, in their positions. And it's Rhaenyra who tries to smooth it over, by offering her son's hand in marriage to Allison's daughter, to Helaena. We'll join our houses. Everything will be great. We will align ourselves once and for all. We'll put all of this behind us. We were friends once. We can be friends again. And Viserys is very interested in this, but it is not really falling on Allison's ears.
Right. So Rhaenyra's kid marrying Viserys's kid. So that's
we got to do some math, I think, real quick.
Nephew marrying aunt?
It would be I think that is correct.
Okay.
Which we've done versions of on Game of Thrones, you know?
Yeah, it's funny that they're just, I mean, I know we're just in the world of the show, but they're just like, there's no discussion about that. They're like, yeah, sure, of course. Like, why not? Yeah.
It is always worth taking a beat to just like say that out loud, you know?
Yeah. I'm like that meme of the lady with like the math figures. I'm like, it's swirling around here, her. Like, I'm just like, wait, that is the connection, right? You know?
Because, yeah.
I mean, and obviously that proposal seems to be swatted down pretty quickly, right? Like, should I be keeping that in mind for the future?
She certainly says, we'll consider it. And right. If it was Viserys, and if Viserys was a stronger person, maybe in that moment, he would have just said, yeah, let's do this. But Allison, who has asserted herself a whole lot more, is basically saying, we'll talk about it privately. Thank you for offering this publicly in front of everybody. There's also the moment where Rhaenyra is lactating. Mm-hmm. Allison points this out. I don't know how you read this. Did you read this as like a sign of friendship? Is this a display of power? I think it's certainly very thematically resonant in this room filled with men, this very personal moment that happens here.
I think it's a mix. It's a mix of sort of a knee jerk thing out of the past of like empathy and like, oh, you know, like you got something on your, you know, on your teeth or whatever.
Right.
But there's also the other aspect of it, which is like this kind of performative pity, like, oh, poor you, you know, kind of mean girl stuff. And
right.
But like, I think that both of those are in there, which is, you know, again, why this dynamic between these two characters is so intriguing. And I think it's going to be an ever evolving thing, because there is still, again, some care passing between them, I think, or maybe I'm being naive.
No, I think keep hope alive. That's never done anybody wrong on a Game of Thrones show.
Right.
So, yeah. You know, maybe the torch won't always be green. So Viserys and Alicent, they will go to Viserys's chambers. And yeah, I guess she does basically outright say, like, yeah, that deal is going to be done when I'm in my grave. You know, she's really out on it. Lionel is going to come in. He's going to try and resign. And Viserys, short of hearing Lionel outright say the reason, he wants to hear the words. He wants to hear it in plain English. Why are you resigning? What is this huge rumor? What is this huge shadow that has been cast over you that is causing you, my by far most trusted and most effective advisor in my entire reign? Mm-hmm. What is it that's causing you to resign so suddenly? And Lionel, out of protection of his son, won't say it. He won't say the words. So he does not get to resign. Your resignation is rejected.
Just two grandpas, you know, talking to each other.
Mm-hmm.
We're not talking about the grandkids, even though they have the same grandkids. But
yeah.
And yet you do feel for Lionel, because it's like, what an impossible situation to be in. You know, like, you do this and that looks bad. You do that and that looks bad. You know, it's just like there's no winning, really. You know, I is this the moment you think where Viserys is kind of lifting that veil of willful idiocy? Like, do you think he actually wanted to hear it, or?
Hard to say. Yeah. I mean, because I think if Lionel does say it, Viserys, especially with Alicent in the room, has sort of like, I don't know about that. I don't know if there's an exact action plan that's in place, but one thing kind of follows the other, right? You know, I don't know that that's the way he wants this to go. So I'm not sure what he's hoping for from Lionel. I don't think he wants to hear that. I don't think he wants to be right about this.
No.
But he gives him the opportunity.
He's a meeker guy surrounded by a lot more aggressive people, you know. And, we haven't really seen him. It's not like, you know, opening part of Game of Thrones and Ned Stark beheads someone, you know. Like Viserys is more, it's gentler and whatever. And, yeah, I think a big part of him not wanting to acknowledge it, he's like, well, then I have to do something about it.
You know? Right. You know? And, right. Yeah.
And then it's taking care of for him in a way.
Yeah, right. Exactly. But I think that Lionel Strong in this moment is a very compelling mirror to Otto Hightower, who is going to be evoked in just a second here, about a lot of where we are right now. You can lay at the feet of Otto Hightower. Viserys certainly did when he fired him, right? How much of this did you see? How much of this did you know? How much did you put on my path of putting Alicent here and having your grandchildren, potentially be in line for the Iron Throne? How much power did you know you could go and grab? Where here you have yet another hand of the king, who also has the king's shares the king's grandchildren, who's not comfortably living with that. Who does not have these grandchildren because of some grand design of his,
no.
Some angle at the throne. And in fact, almost Kristen Cole-ish, cannot help but, you know, come out with the truth or close to the truth. I just thought it was a really, really interesting mirror of those two characters. We are going to go and see, Lionel Strong's other son, who we have not seen in this episode yet, and who has been slowly tiptoeing his way into the narrative, and then decides to just cannonball into the pool as of this episode. Larys Strong, aka Larys Clubfoot, who I guess is Alicent's dinner buddy. They dine together with some regularity, it seems.
Yeah, their dynamic is I don't really know what to make of it yet. Like, it doesn't seem like it's romantic. But, you know, we see Larys, you know, in pre-time jump, like, give Lady Alicent a really crucial bit of information.
Right.
That has huge consequences. And maybe we're to understand that in the ensuing 10 years that she was in some ways learning from him and sort of under his tutelage in a way. And maybe that's her kind of new flintiness and cunning is maybe partly owed to him. But clearly, as we see in this episode, he is willing to go a lot further than she is. And, that, you know, so I'm curious, like, is he overstepping or is this like him just asserting himself that much more?
Right. And the way he's gonna talk to her about this at the end of the episode makes it feel like he kind of has the viewpoint of, no, this is what you wanted. And if you burn me, I'll burn you. And I don't really know how that's going to ultimately work out unless some bit of what we're talking about here of like the last decade of their relationship, how much information has been passing between the two of them? Right. What kind of, what kind of collateral does Laris have over Allison over the course of those years? Is there some version of mutually assured destruction between the gossip exchange between these two people? But what we get from this scene between Allison and Laris is Allison once again talking about how her husband just refuses to see the truth, and that she feels like the king cannot be turned away from, cannot be turned towards the truth, especially with Lionel Strong still on the council. And at the very least, if her father was here, he'd be giving him the right information. And Laris may be playing a part to a little bit of an extent, maybe being, authentic to some degree, too. I think that they're leaving it vague at the moment, at the very least, of your dad wouldn't be able to give your husband unbiased counsel because he's your father. And she says, yeah, that's the point. I need someone who's going to be partial to me. And Laris walk away from that interaction being like, okay, cool. Then I'll chop off the tongues of some prisoners in the basement and I'll have them burn my dad alive.
Right. And my brother.
Yeah, my brother too, if he's there.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is a real coming out party for Laris Strong. This is really, from off the backboard. This is just, he was really just lurking in the distance for a minute and now he is right in our faces.
I don't think it's an accident that his name rhymes with Varys.
Yes.
And I think the show had been needing this. Damon had sort of been the villain, but one that whose villainy was complicated and not always, we wanted a sort of Littlefinger creeper kind of, almost also a little bit Tyrion.
Yeah.
That kind of maligned, ostracized, but secretly very powerful kind of figure. And I think this is a good debut. I mean, we've seen Laris before, but this is really his coming out party. And it's, I think it's, he's really well played by the actor,
Matthew Needham.
Yep. Yeah. And I love the way that they, toward the end of this episode, have him almost doing some sort of voiceover about like the perils of love and having children and all that stuff. It's really, he kind of is now setting this sort of thematic mood for the show, which I appreciate.
He's creepy. There is something very creepy about him too. As we go into the dungeons and we see everybody lining up to get their tongues taken out, and he's just gesturing people over. Okay, next, with his finger. It is just it is really, really, really bone chilling. And I think you're right. I think that this is a Game of Thrones type that we are now firmly fixing in House of the Dragon. Not really the the tension relieving of a Tyrion Lannister, right? Like this is actually the opposite of cutting through the levity, I think. Or giving us some levity rather. Still wish that we had a little bit of that. But what we are getting at the very least is the schemer in the dark. The chaos is a ladder character. Right. He's climbing right now.
He doesn't want to be king. He can't be, I don't think. Maybe he sees a path for that. I don't know if that's his goal, but better to be kind of right behind the ruler than the ruler itself.
Pick a path and try to make it work out, I think seems to be where he's going. And whether that's a straight line or very zigzaggy, I think remains to be seen. But I think the fact that he's going to make this move against his own family very quickly with, he's been in three episodes essentially. I think really indicates to us that for this character, there's nothing he won't do. So I think that they very effectively conveyed that in this episode, that this guy's going to be willing to do just about anything to suit his needs, whatever those needs might be. We lose Lena Valerian in this next set of scenes, Richard. We find ourselves really back in the same situation that Viserys was in and that Queen Emma was in the pilot. Which it dawns on me now, just framing it that way, that we are sort of in pilot number two. Once again, I think history repeating itself to a certain extent.
Yeah, and I think there was a bit of foreshadowing where Lena said, I want to die a dragon rider's death, not, you know, sort of just some pampered person sitting in a palace. And then that's in some ways what she got, you know. I didn't think it was going to be so soon, but I think it was interesting where, you know, clearly like the maester, whoever took Daemon aside, he was like, all right, well, here are our options and they're not good, you know, that the show didn't make Daemon make that choice. Right. You know, that it at least gave that to Lena, which was like this was done on her terms, which it very much wasn't with Viserys.
Yeah, she gets up and she goes and she approaches Vhagar and has Vhagar incinerate her. And Vhagar is reluctant to do so. This old dragon that has bonded with Lena does not want to do it, but ultimately succumbs to the wishes of his rider. And she is gone. And in the book, she actually does not quite make it to Vhagar, if I'm remembering this right. I think that she dies en route to Vhagar, okay. But she does. I don't remember if she had given birth and the baby didn't survive, and then she goes. I have to refresh myself on this portion of the book. It's different though. Mm-hmm. It's different in this instance. She gets to go out the dragon rider's way, as you mentioned before. But Daemon watches that, and Daemon is there, and I think that we are left to wonder where that's putting him and where that's putting his daughters and how they are going to fit back into the story. Obviously, all of them are just brutally wrecked by what has happened here. We'll check in with them again in sort of this episode-ending montage that's coming up. But first, we're going to have a final meeting between Sir Harwin and his kids, who don't know that he is their father. At least not officially. Jace suspects it. He wants to know, is Harwin Strong my father? Am I a bastard? And Rhaenyra is going to tell him, you're a Targaryen, and that's all that matters. But this scene of Harwin leaving, maybe even especially now in hindsight, Richard, I wonder if it plays even more tragically to you.
Yeah, no, I think that was kind of the moment when I realized that, like, for the most part, there had been 10 years of the closest these people get to harmony, you know, like, yes, it was an imperfect situation, but like their dad was around, you know, maybe they didn't know that he was their dad and then no one could say it out loud, but like they were a family. And then because of matters of state and whatever, it has to be broken up. And I think that only, I would imagine, hardens Rhaenyra that much more. And she had her 10 years of relative, you know, comfort, contentedness, whatever you want to call it. And now that is definitively over.
Yeah, and I think this is going to manifest in the form of her deciding to leave King's Landing and you know, go to Dragonstone and get out of here. And even Laenor is going to say, but you know, you always used to say that if we left, then Alicent is the only one in your father's ear, and that could not be good for us. That could only be bad. And she's kind of in a place where she basically throws his old, you know, adages about, you got to drive into the storm. Isn't that what all of you Valyrians are always talking about? And she doesn't want to be here. She doesn't want to be here anymore. I think in no small part, the rumors swirling to the extent that they have, who knows what kind of danger she could be in, especially with Breakbones gone, without his direct protection here as well, that she's lost a lot of friends here in King's Landing. And maybe it's time for a fresh start, or at least some measure of distance between us and them. So they are going to leave. Carl gets the invite. They're going to go to Dragonstone, and that's where they will be. They will roll up to Dragonstone in that final montage of the episode that is on the other side of Harwin and Lionel returning to the cursed castle, Harrenhal. Stay in one person's hands for too long, so the stories go. And so it really does not for Lionel and Harwin. It looks like they don't even get a night before it is ablaze, set on fire by Larys's bumblebee crew. And this was another one, Richard, that it's left ambiguous in the book, how they died. I think that even Viserys is under some suspicion. Did he order this because of the rumors of Harwin Strong? And was he so scandalized by it that he did something very cowardly and assassinated these people? The show is giving us their version of events.
Right.
So I was interested to see how this was ultimately going to play out. The show is making a decision. This is Larys who is killing his family.
Harrenhal is evoked a lot in the original Song of Ice and Fire books. Sort of like thematic, like whispery past kind of creepy stuff. You know, there's nothing really present tense about it in the plot of the books, but like it's part of the mythology that I always found interesting. So, and it's this, you know, husk of an old burnt down castle kind of thing. Is this the fire that caused it? Is this the thing?
No. So okay. You can see it in the shot when they're getting to Harrenhal that it already looks pretty wrecked. It's like, why are we fighting over this place? Why does anyone want to live here? But no, it is. It was ruined in Aegon's conquest in this really, really memorable way of Black Harren is like the cruel king who is in charge of Harrenhal, and he is resisting the conquest, and he's built his castle in such a way that you're not going to melt my castle down. It's not possible, and so instead. Aegon lights it up and heats it up, and it becomes the kettle boils, and everybody inside of it does as well, and it starts to melt and break down. And this is the way that it's left essentially, and it just does not stay in anybody's hands for too long for anyone to really do any sort of meaningful repair to Harrenhal. So I do think it's very symbolic, this castle. Of a lot of the ideas that are at play in the Game of Thrones universe of, you know, you can have the castle, but for how long? You know, you can have the throne, but for how long? And so that's effectively it. We are going to see, both Harwin and Lionel desperately try to get out. They cannot. They do not survive this. They are both killed in this fire. And to your point, there's this, you know, Larys's closing monologue. He does not have a mustache to twirl, Richard. No. That is the only thing that's missing.
He does have that kind of sinister cane, you know, that he kind of wields. It's a well-drawn character, an interestingly drawn character. And I think that sort of voiceover thing toward the end, which is so effective, is a really good, like, kind of narrative tool where it's like, all right, this is now where we're at. You know, like, we are... familial connections see, you know, matter no more, you know, I mean, they do, but like they can be broken, you know? And so I think that that's the show telling us like, all right, well, this is now the things are really ramping into gear that we have been talking about since episode one, but now actually it's happening.
Yeah. So that is episode six. That's the princess and the queen, Richard.
I'm excited. I think this is. I was worried about the transition, but I think they did it well. And I think more than I did for the first five episodes. Like, I really feel like what the stakes of this are, you know. And the big question for me is Daemon, but otherwise, I'm all in.
How much of that do you think owes to, you know, there's been a lot of talk about the pacing of those first five. I think some people think it was slow. Others would say that they churned through material almost too quickly. Do you feel like where we are right now is really living on the bedrock of having the time to spend with a younger Rhaenyra, a younger Alicent, to really understand the extent of the hurt that these characters have been living with and may, as a result, their internalization of that hurt could get externalized to others?
Yeah, I think that it helped. I think the first five episodes, like, this is a big family saga, you know, a dynastic power struggle. And I think that you can jump into that right, you know, at the climax, essentially. But I think it's better storytelling to really like spend some time getting to know people and not every character, certainly, but like the really important ones. So then that the payoffs are that much more satisfying and, you know, the surprise is that much more surprising. And, you know, this is a show that is, in theory, going to run for seasons. And so we're settling into things, you know, even though I feel sometimes the plot in individual episodes can feel a little bit hasty, from a step back, I think the show is very like patiently drawn. And so I appreciate that we spent all the time in the younger years because it, you know, it registers that much more keenly now.
Very curious to hear what everyone out there listening to Still Watching is thinking about the time jump, thinking about the ascension of Emma D'Arcy and Olivia Cooke to the roles of Rhaenyra and Alicent. Please write in. We'd love to hear from you. StillWatchingPod@gmail.com. StillWatchingPod@gmail.com. Your thoughts on those questions and anything else from episode six and where we might be barreling towards in episode 7 and beyond. I could tell you based on the title of next week's episode, Richard, we probably know where we are barreling toward. Driftmark is the name of episode 7.
Yes, and we haven't seen the sea snake in the
10
time
years.
Jump yet, right?
So like, a solid decade.
You know, he has a dead daughter now, a son who has had to essentially kind of not flee, but like leave King's Landing. I think he's going to come roaring back.
I think that that's a fair assumption. So we will see what all of that looks like when we reopen Still Watching next week. Between now and then, Richard, where can folks find you and what do you got going on?
Just at vf.com, writing reviews like normal. I think I'm going to write something. I'm going to go see Avatar 3D, the re-release in theaters.
Ooh, and
see
if, you and see me if both.
The movie. I haven't seen the movie since I saw it in theaters however many years ago. So people can keep an eye out for that in the coming weeks.
Amazing. Very fun. You can find me on Twitter at Round Howard. You can find me on vf.com as well. Recapping House of the Dragon here each and every week, including next week when we come back for episode 7. Before we close out, huge shout out to the great man behind the scenes, Dave Gonzalez, the true secret father of Still Watching, without whom this podcast would not be possible. So thank you to Dave for making this podcast come together. We will be back next week with more Still Watching House of the Dragon. Until then, everybody, take care. Bye-bye.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.